This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to BGov's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My name is Alan Scott. Now, this is the place where government actions come face-to-face with business decisions. Online at www.bgov.com. And, of course, on the air at Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. And there are quite a few topics that, when mashed together, will always make for an interesting story. And this one definitely has it all. Let's see. We've got lawyers. Check. We got drugs. Check. We got money. Check. All three of those combined, never fails, make for a great story. And Brian Rye is here to tell it. He's a Bloomberg government analyst who's managed to put all of those words together in the tale of how the Justice Department may be cashing in on drug makers and providers. But what makes it really scary, this adds the element of surprise, it could be happening to you, the insurer, next. Brian, how are you?
I'm good, Alan. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Was that a little salacious? Too much? Was I over?
That sounds great. I actually enjoyed writing this very much. It's an interesting topic to delve into and research, and I hope everyone will enjoy having a chance to read it.
You know what? As I'm reading this, and if I were a government employee, especially with the Justice Department, I'm going ka-ching, because we're talking billions of dollars here.
You know, every year, the last 3 years especially, have seen record set each year. In 2012, there were over the $3 billion in healthcare fraud settlements and judgments alone, about $5 billion total. And the reason it's so attractive for the Justice Department, and when I'm speaking of healthcare, drug makers and providers, is this is sort of a volume-based activity. And so there are hundreds of millions of claims filed every year by providers with federal healthcare programs, Medicare and even Medicaid. And to the extent that the government alleges that there's some fraudulent activity going on, they have a very wide latitude in terms of their ability to go after these companies and the amount of money that they can extract from them. And you might ask, well, you know, sort of a one-sided situation here. Why don't the companies fight back?
And well, yeah. I mean, why are they? Because it seems like they're rolling over and just settling for the most part.
Well, they are. Now, we want to be clear that a lot of times they're doing so because they're guilty of sin, and it's in their best interest to do that.
That was Brian Rye.
we certainly don't want to whitewash any actual instances of malfeasance out there. However, our point is that when something is alleged, the fact that the government has wide latitude in terms of the amount of money they can provide, as well as the so-called debarment option, the ability to eliminate the company's ability to do business with the federal government. And we walk through an example. HCA, one of the major hospital chains in the country, has more than 160 hospitals worldwide. In 2003, for example, they settled a claim under the False Claims Act, paid about $630 million to settle the civil allegations. That may seem like a lot of money, but in 2012 alone, the amount of revenues that HCA generated from the Medicare and Medicaid programs exceeded $14 billion. So a drop in the bucket to them. And again, this is not something that's an idle threat. It's not something that the government really wants to do. But as an example, in 2002, I believe, Arthur Anderson was excluded from doing federal business because of their involvement or allegations of wrongdoing in connection with the Enron scandal. That case was ultimately thrown out, actually, by the Supreme Court, but the damage had been done and Arthur Anderson was out of business.
Let's take a step back here, because there are those who may not. I knew that this was going on. I had no idea that it was to the volume or the magnitude that you're talking about here in this analysis. Let's back up and talk about the False Claims Act. This has been around for quite some time.
It has. It dates back to actually the Civil War, and some people call this the Lincoln Law. It was signed by President Lincoln in response to some unscrupulous contractors who were providing the Union Army some provisions that were either rancid, maybe mules that were crippled, and those things that really today may seem ridiculous. But back then, there was no FDA, there was no USDA, there was no sort of authority to check these things as they were being manufactured.
Right.
And so this was a way for the government to sort of make sure, provide another safeguard against those activities. For decades, it sort of sat there, was sort of a quiet law, but in the mid-80s, in response to a couple of high-profile defense contractors that sort of had their hands caught in the cookie jar, President Reagan signed enhancements to the law that really broadened not only the reach of the law, but the scope of the penalties available to the government and the prosecutors. And since then, it's sort of almost been a hockey stick in terms of the growth aspect of these cases. And it's been both Republican and Democrats that have done so, although we have seen a significant increase in the last 3 years under the Obama Holder administration. And as I mentioned, the attractiveness of the healthcare industry is purely based on the number of claims that are filed. These violations and the amount of dollars that can be available to the government are based on the number of claims alleged to be fraudulent. And again, if you've got companies submitting hundreds of millions of claims every year to Medicare and Medicaid, it becomes potentially a cash register.
The amount of money that the return on the investment, so to speak, is like 6-1.
Yeah,
like,
you know,
it's insane.
You know, purely from a monetary perspective, you as a taxpayer wish that all programs were this efficient.
Yeah.
You know, right now, I think the last 3 years, it's over $7 for every $1 expended. Return, and that's significantly higher than the average. And so they're very good at what they do. And again, because of sort of the debarment threat and the wide leverage and the wide latitude they have in negotiating these settlements, more often it's usually in the company's best interest just to sign, get this out of the way, and move on.
Looking at the top 20, and by the way, we're speaking with Brian Rye. He's an analyst with Bloomberg Government, who's penned an analysis called Government Cashes In on Fraud here on BGov's Capital Impact right here on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. And the more claims that are out there, the more I almost liken them to these just gigantic class action lawsuits where the government is the beneficiary. And the more of them out there, the more money they're going to make.
And that's it. You know, and there's also the incentive. A lot of these start as whistleblower suits, and hundreds of millions of dollars, have found their way to these individuals initially blowing the whistle in the companies that the government actually joins. But you're right. And you look at the top 20 cases of all time, 18 of them involve healthcare companies, and most of those are drug makers.
Yeah.
And, it's not even the drug makers actually don't even file claims with Medicare, Medicaid, but they can still be found guilty under these acts.
Now, in the top 20, I mean, you've got GlaxoSmithKline, Pfizer, Bank of America Corp, Tenet Healthcare Corp. Are these, like, looking at the number one here, GlaxoSmithKline, for example, is that one particular instance or is that multiple instances that they've lumped together and decided to settle?
Yeah, typically it's both. You know, okay. It's usually one case, but the case may involve multiple instances of maybe off-label promotion of multiple drugs, and they sort of lump those in there. And again, it's over maybe a specific time period that the government has alleged, but it's very wide in scope.
When a drug becomes eligible for a generic label, so to speak, is it the Wild Wild West at that point? Is that where a lot of these are coming from?
Not so much.
Okay.
I think most of these are prior to a drug losing its patent protection, because then those are the companies that have the money. And if you're the government and you want to get the highest return you possibly can, you want to go after the brand name drug makers that are making billions of dollars off these drugs. Once a drug goes generic, it becomes less of an emphasis and is less heavily and less aggressively marketed by these companies. And those are sometimes the practices that are being alleged by the government.
Makes sense. So I made mention at the beginning of the program that this could impact you and I, people who are just insured parties who could be impacted by this. We fast forward to 2013. The Affordable Care Act has a provision in it where an insured party may be on the hook for some of this drug money. Please elaborate.
So the Affordable Care Act, when it was passed in 2010, contained several provisions regarding these new health insurance exchanges that go live at the beginning of 2014. Now, most of the attention has been focused on, will states have their own exchange or will they join the federal exchange, what have you. But buried in the Affordable Care Act, actually, Section 1313, if you're having trouble sleeping one night and want to flip through this.
Written on Mockingbird Lane, by the way.
Exactly. It contains a very specific provision that these exchanges will be subject to the False Claims Act. Any money or any claims going by, through, or in connection with these exchanges, as long as they involve federal funds. Well, a lot of the people that are expected to be enrolled in these insurance exchanges may be low, moderate income folks that are getting some tax credits or subsidies, and those are federal funds. And so, you know, we speculate that it could be a number of folks that fall, you know, both providers and insurers. But from, again, a volume-based standpoint, it's going to be the insurance companies where a lot of these claims are going to be flowing through. And so if you're the government and wanting to, again, sort of maximize the return on your investment, it makes a lot more sense to target the high volume folks. And, you know, what could that be? It's tough to say because, again, these things haven't gone live yet, but you're talking about a heavily regulated industry. Check. You're talking about millions, you know, of Americans. I think a Deloitte study said that over 40 million Americans would be in these exchanges maybe by the year 2019. Check. And then you've got an area of healthcare, which is already sort of ripe for fraud just based on the number of complexity of claims being filed. And so, for instance, if you're a health insurance company and maybe you've got some folks who use false identification to enroll in your plans, and you've got a lot of those folks. Well, sure, the government could go after those folks, but it's going to be a lot easier for them to say that you didn't do your job when you enrolled them in the first place, and though in this, you know, any claims going through you would fall under the False Claims Act and be subject to that. Likewise, there are lots of eligibility requirements for the insurance companies themselves to participate in the exchange. And so I think there's going to be a lot of scrutiny on those folks. And I think another reason why the insurance companies may catch the eye of the Justice Department is that the attractiveness of the drug companies may have recently decreased just a little bit because of a recent court ruling. You know, one of the main thrusts of the government when they go after these drug companies is that is the so-called off-label promotion.
And, this is, we're talking about Coronia.
Yeah, the Coronia case. Yeah. It's not a light beer. It's an actual a court decision. Essentially, in this case, you know, the Food and Drug Administration, when they approve a drug, they approve it only for a very specific disease or condition. Now, despite that, you know, doctors can prescribe a drug for anything they want.
I was going to say, you know, they're talking about antidepressants to get rid of smoking and various other things.
Exactly. And so you have sort of an inconsistency here where doctors can prescribe a drug for anything they see fit, irrespective of what the FDA has ruled. But a drug company representative, for example, can only talk about the specific use under most conditions, specific use that the FDA has approved. Not to say, again, that there aren't companies that are already, you know, going well over the line. But
they want you to use their drug. They want you to prescribe the drug. They want to do anything they can to get that drug in you.
Exactly. But from a legal standpoint, you can sort of see the inconsistency where, you know, CMS will reimburse a provider for providing a drug for off-label use, but a separate government agency, you know, says that it's not legal for that same drug company to then talk about, a truthful, misleading statement of that. Well, the court decision, the Coronia one we're speaking of, the Second Circuit Court of Appeals in New York, said that no, by itself, if a statement is truthful and misleading, it's protected under the First Amendment. And so that off-label promotion in and of itself is not illegal. And you know, it remains to be seen how this is going to impact the strategies of prosecutors going forward. On one hand, they may just simply say, well, we sort of disagree, but what it does do, irrespective, it does sort of increase the burden of proof on prosecutors because they now have to prove that, okay, it may be truthful and not misleading, but it's still intent. You know, it proves the intent in and of itself that the company wanted to promote something despite the lack of instructions on the FDA label. So drug companies, you know, may be becoming a bit less of an attractive target, or drug companies may be more willing to fight these charges in the wake of the Coronia ruling. But at the same time, here comes the new health exchanges that opens up a brand new world of potential business, for lack of a better term.
Another stream of income.
For the Justice Department.
For the Justice Department. So we're obviously in the beginning stages of a sequestration. The sequester is underway. Drawing down and cutting and such is happening at a gradually increasing pace. How does that impact?
It does. It does impact it. It obviously impacts everything to varying degrees. I think what you're going to see here is not a lessening of the appetite to go after these cases, but maybe a shift in resources and probably a delay in actually prosecuting some of these cases. In December, Attorney General Holder indicated that you know, resources might be shifted to protect things that are more directly involved with the public safety, ensuring, for example, that the federal prison system is isn't disrupted at all. And so some civil investigations such as these that fall under the False Claims Act may be postponed for a while. All that's going to do is just build an already huge backlog. I think at the end of 2012, there were more than 2,000 criminal cases under investigation, another 1,000 civil matters pending. So this is just going to add to that. You know, eventually they'll work through them. But again, it remains to be seen as we shift into this new world of sequestration, exactly how aggressive they maintain the current rate of prosecution.
With more work dumping on the pile daily and fewer people to do it, it should be interesting to see how 2013 pans out. Brian Rye, any further comments about your latest analysis, government cashes in on fraud?
You know, I think the nugget I would want to leave people with is that healthcare has been and will continue to be an attractive source of funds, you know, for the Justice Department. Now, again, a lot of these funds get transferred back into the Medicare trust fund. So there is, in a small way, sort of a deficit reduction component of this. And you're slowing the growth of Medicare spending. $23 billion has been poured back into the Medicare trust fund since 1997. So from a fiscal standpoint, you know, it makes a lot of sense for both Republicans and Democrats to continue down this path. Now, there may be some shifts in exactly what areas or sectors within healthcare get targeted. But if you're within healthcare, I think next to the FDA, probably the Justice Department is the one agency you want to be paying most attention to.
His name is Brian Rye, an analyst with Bloomberg Government. Government cashes in on fraud. The Justice Department annually collects billions from drug makers and providers. Our insurers next is what it's called. Look for it on BGov.com. Brian, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Alan.
You're listening to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact right here on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM in Washington, D.C., where there's a huge debate going on about our nation's borders. Open them, close them, more protection, less protection. Republicans say, well, we need more people out there to keep everyone else out. Close the borders practically. While President Obama, he's going down the path that, you know what, we've done all we can, and there's no more money to spend on what it is you Republicans are proposing. So, by the way, it's ridiculous. And that's kind of the side note that he throws out there from time to time. In walks Matthew Hummer, BGov analyst, who's written Toward a Smarter Approach to Border Control. Maybe it's something they should read. Matt, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Alan.
So this could basically be summed up, and I kind of did it right there, as like a Republicans versus Democrats who's going to win kind of match.
Right, exactly. But the key is we haven't seen either of them win out in recent days or months for that matter, or years. So really what this is suggesting is, hey, maybe there's a smart approach, something that's more in between for both parties, is we can actually take a look at what's driving immigration, illegal border crossings, and target spending based on that. And what our BGov analysis finds is that illegal border crossings tend to go up when the U.S. economy outperforms the Mexican economy, and so we can target spending according to that.
Imagine that. Yeah. The dollar worth more than the peso, and what happens? They open the doors and everyone comes in. Not that there's a problem with that. I have no problems with people coming through across the border legally.
Sure.
Because illegal border crossings then does nothing more than strain the economy, the U.S. economy, when trying, as we are, the melting pot, so to speak, right. Taking care of everyone. But this is over the next few years, we were just kind of discussing this a second ago, the U.S. economy probably not going to perform as well as the Mexican economy. Will we see a shift at all?
Right, and that's exactly what our analysis shows. And basically over the last couple of years, since about 2006, began a precipitous decline in illegal border crossings. And that is largely because the Mexican economy has been growing more than the U.S. economy. And our analysis shows that that's set to continue for at least the next 2 years. Mexico's economy is expected to grow about 3.5%, while the U.S. economy will grow at a max, maybe 2%. So if you can imagine that, the trend will continue, keeping illegal border crossings at their lowest levels since the 1970s, and maybe this call for additional spending isn't really necessary.
Let's talk about this additional spending, because it's a lot of money that they're proposing or would like to see put in place to put the measures necessary to prevent the illegal border crossings. Over the next few years, how much money are we talking about potentially spending?
Sure. We estimate that it would take about $28 billion a year to fully secure the border between U.S. and Mexico. And that actually couldn't happen for at least 5 years. So put that out till about 2019. What we're currently spending on securing the border is about $11.6 billion. So like I said, it's roughly double. And finding that kind of money in this type of budget environment, nearly impossible.
Tossing in a nice little unnecessary sequester at the same time, you got money being taken off the table. Janet Napolitano just a week or so ago said that it's a 70-30 kind of thing, 70% employees, 30% contractors, and the contractors are likely going to go. So I don't see where this money is going to come from. That's just my own personal opinion.
Yeah, you're exactly right. A lot of that money does go to contractors to help secure the border. And, you know, they're doing an adequate job now. Levels are at their lowest they've been since the 1970s. And what we're saying is they're going to continue to be low, hopefully. But, yeah, with less people, you're going to have to make those dollars go further. So hopefully they'll find a way to do it.
Mexican manufacturing seems to be booming at this point, causing the economy to be a little bit better than that of the United States, at least for the next few years. That's likely going to quell, as you mentioned, the crossings illegally, at least. Smarter approach to the entire thing is what is necessary, according to Mr. Matthew Homer.
And then just one more note on that. With the manufacturing, the largest cohort of folks that actually cross the border are males between the age of 18 and 24. And those are the ones that are actually due to get those jobs in manufacturing. So by the booming nature of the actual manufacturing industry could actually prove to be a worthy alternative to actually crossing the border illegally.
Mr. Matthew Homer has written an analysis toward a smarter approach to border control, a potential way to save U.S. security frauds. Look for it on bgov.com. Matthew, thanks for being here.
No problem. Thank you.
Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano had quite a bit to say about border protection, especially in the world of sequestration.
We're going to have to continue to check for contraband, for potential terrorists and the like, passengers as well as containers and other cargo. So the procedures will be the same, but we'll have fewer people able to do them, so the lines are going to get longer. And between the ports, we are going to see a reduction in Border Patrol resources between the ports of entry. So it's really a very, it's as I said last week at a hearing, it's almost an out-of-body experience. Last week I was testifying in the Congress before the Judiciary Committee on the need for immigration reform, and I was being asked, what are we doing to strengthen security at the border? And the very next day, and we have put record amounts of resources into the border and our border security, and the very next day, I was in the Appropriations Committee saying, but that you're taking and rolling it all back through sequestration. So it's really
a border less secure if you're taking away hours of
between the ports of entry. If you reduce the number of Border Patrol agents, I think you can say, yes, it does affect our ability to keep out illegal migrants and others trying to enter the country. Let me close by saying this. Threats from terrorism and the need to respond and recover from natural disasters do not diminish because of budget cuts. Even in the current fiscal climate, we do not have the luxury of making significant reductions to our capabilities without significant impacts. We will work to continue to preserve our frontline priorities as best we can, but no amount of planning can mitigate the negative effects of sequestration.
Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano. And with that, we put the wraps on yet another edition of Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact. Make sure you tune in to WUSA TV9 Sundays at 11:30 a.m. Immediately following Face the Nation, you'll find Bloomberg Government's Capital Gains, hosted by Bloomberg Television's Peter Cook. That's Sundays at 11:30, immediately following Face the Nation on WUSA TV9. I'll be back next Thursday with plenty more to say about the business impact of government actions. For BGov's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio 1500 AM, I'm Alan Scott.